Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 21st of November, these are our main stories. Queen Elizabeth's son, Prince Andrew, has announced that he's stepping back from public duties because of the controversy surrounding his links with a convicted American sex offender. Donald Trump and senior members of his administration have challenged dramatic testimony by a senior US diplomat, Gordon Sondland, at the impeachment hearings in Washington. Iran is reported to have jailed a group of wildlife experts on charges of spying. Also in this podcast.
Hello, my name is Maribel Ayala and I'm Spanish.
Marhaba, my name is Fadi and I come from Lebanon.
Hi, my name is Bart and I'm from Poland.
But we find out later why there's bad news for holders of British passports. One of Queen Elizabeth's sons, Prince Andrew, has announced that he's stepping back from public duties because of what he called his ill-judged association with the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. He released a statement after an attempt to clear the air in a BBC interview broadcast on Saturday was widely deemed to have been a public relations disaster. This statement has been voiced by one of our producers.
It has become clear to me over the last few days that the circumstances relating to my former association with Jeffrey Epstein has become a major disruption to my family's work and the valuable work going on in the many organisations and charities that I am proud to support. Therefore, I have asked Her Majesty if I may step back from public duties for the foreseeable future, and she has given her permission. I continue to unequivocally regret my ill-judged association with Jeffrey Epstein. His suicide has left many unanswered questions, particularly for his victims, and I deeply sympathise with everyone who has been affected and wants some form of closure. I can only hope that in time they will be able to rebuild their lives. Of course, I am willing to help any appropriate law enforcement agency with their investigations, if required.
Various institutions and companies had already said they wanted to end or were thinking of ending their association with the prince. So what does all this mean for Prince Andrew's reputation? I spoke to our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
Well, it means that the pressure has become too much, that after the interview that he gave on Saturday, the reaction to that, both from the public, from commentators and from the sort of private world, the corporate interests that supported the charitable work that he was connected to. He has effectively sort of seen the way in which this is going, and it's all bad, or it was all bad. And so he says in a very open, almost emotional statement that he is stepping back from public duties for the foreseeable future. Well, he says a whole things that the sort of things he didn't say in the interview as well. He says he unequivocally regrets what he calls his ill-judged association with Jeffrey Epstein. He talks about the victims, which, again, he failed to do in the interview. He says he deeply sympathises with everyone who's been affected. And he says he will assist the appropriate law enforcement agencies with their investigations, again, which wasn't made clear in the...
Does that mean he could get on a plane and fly to the United States?
Well, we don't know at the moment. And again, it's carefully phrased. There are an awful lot of lawyers in America who are asking him to give sworn statements, to give depositions. He's not saying he's going to do that. He's saying if the FBI, the British police, the French police want a statement, then he will assist them. And that could well mean, in fact, that they come over here and take a statement.
Is this going to draw a line under the affair?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it draws a line under it for the royal family, for the institution, for the palace, because it is taking him out of the public side. It doesn't draw a line under all the questions that still remain about why for so long he was friends with Jeffrey Epstein, about the apparent inconsistencies in the interview and various other reports of his behaviour. Though there are still questions to be asked about the affair itself. And so investigations, I'm sure, will continue, but they don't have that royal spotlight that they have had for so long.
And what does the foreseeable future mean?
I find it difficult to see how he steps back into public duties without some real form of closure, i.e. some investigative authority saying it was nothing to do with him. You know, this is going to hang over him and it's very difficult to see how it will be cleared. So this may well be the end for Prince Andrew in terms of his public duties and his public life.
Our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond. Simon Jenkins is a former newspaper editor in Britain who's written several books on the politics and history of England. Tim Franks asked him what he made of the news.
I think it's a welcome announcement. I just don't think it's terribly important. His public duties were not all that onerous. But anyway, it's the obvious response to the very embarrassing situation he finds himself in. So I think it's a sensible decision.
Do you think it's enough in PR terms to staunch the bleeding, to limit the damage that appears to have been caused as a result of his interview with the BBC?
I very much doubt that, because he's gone public with an interview in which he made some very specific comments in his own defence, admittedly, on a matter that's subject to a court case in America. So he's very exposed, and I don't see how he can, in a sense, just withdraw from it. He's vulnerable to subpoena. But it's not obviously a wise thing to do just in public relations terms.
What implications do you think all this has for the royal family, for the institution of the monarchy?
Well, I think you need to understand that Britain is pretty well unlike, if not unique, other surviving monarchies around the world, of which there are dozens, of course, in that back in the 1960s, I think most unwisely, the Queen decided to update the monarchy by making the monarchy embrace the royal family. And this was a quite specific decision to sort of collectivize the monarchy from one individual person, that was herself, to all her children. And it made it seem as if she was, I suppose, being modern. In fact, it made the monarchy vulnerable to any misbehavior on the part of the children. It turned the children into celebrities. As celebrities, they were in the public eye. They carried out public duties. They received public subsidies. And they were inevitably going in what they got up to reflect on the monarchy itself. So it was a very high-risk thing to do. And ever since then, I would have thought she must have been regretting it. But I'm not her.
But there've been all sorts of brushes with ill fortune and bad luck and bad judgment by members of the royal family since then. I mean, one thinks of what happened in particular in the 90s, which was a very turbulent decade for the royal family. And the institution of the monarchy, just in terms of its popularity in the United Kingdom and the sort of the belief that there should still be a monarchy, that doesn't seem to have been particularly affected. Do you think that this episode could change that?
I don't think so. Every monarchy is as good as its monarch in a sense, but on the other hand, it's a very peculiar institution to enshrine the concept of the headship of your state and your nation in an individual chosen by the lot of inheritance, of genetics. So it's in itself a kind of bizarre hangover from the Middle Ages. But given that you've got it, and given that on the whole it works, and it has got widespread public support, the most important thing, I think, is to make sure that the monarch, in a sense, is not a real person. It's the personification of the headship of state. As such, the safest way to do it is the way the Danes, the Norwegians, the Swedes do it, which is to have simply one person who is the national head of state and performs various public duties of a totally uncontroversial nature in the name of the whole state rather than a party or political leadership. And I think that's totally acceptable, provided, of course, that in some sense the individual concerned is dignified enough to reflect the headship of state. Now, when you turn it into a family, you're complicating it hugely by the nature of that family. And I think the problem with the British royal family has always been that it doesn't damage the monarchy existentially. I think the monarchy is very well entrenched in Britain. It does, in a sense, taint the concept of headship of state. And that's the problem that we've had with Prince Charles's marriage, with the other children's activities, and with now with Prince Andrew. It's unhelpful and complicates public life.
The author and journalist Simon Jenkins. A leading diplomat, Gordon Sondland, has said he was following the orders of President Trump when the US put pressure on Ukraine to open politically motivated investigations. Mr. Sondland, who had direct contact with Mr. Trump, told the impeachment inquiry that he believed vital military aid to Ukraine was withheld to try to force its government to launch the probes. He acknowledged that Mr. Trump had never explicitly referred to US security assistance, but said the link between the aid and the political investigations was well known to senior figures in the Trump administration.
Everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. Everyone was informed via email on July 19th, days before the presidential call. As I communicated to the team, I told President Zelensky in advance that assurances to run a fully transparent investigation and turn over every stone were necessary in his call with President Trump.
The Democrat chairing the impeachment hearings, Adam Schiff, said Mr. Sondland's testimony marked a very important moment in the inquiry. He said it was the first time that the committee had been told that knowledge of a scheme to pressure Ukraine was pervasive and extended to other senior officials, including the US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Speaking on the White House lawn in front of a helicopter, President Trump told reporters that he didn't really know Mr. Sondland.
I say to the ambassador in response, I want nothing, I want nothing, I want no quid pro quo. Tell Zelensky, President Zelensky, to do the right thing. So here's my answer. I want nothing. I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo. Tell Zelensky to do the right thing. Then he says, this is the final word from the President of the United States. I want nothing.
President Trump. Tim Franks spoke to our Washington correspondent, Chris Buckler, who's on Capitol Hill, and asked him for more on the background of Gordon Sondland.
Well, Gordon Sondland is someone who was appointed by President Trump, and he was appointed to the position of US ambassador to the European Union. Quite an achievement for somebody who doesn't have a diplomatic background. In fact, he's in the same business as President Trump. He owns and runs hotels, and he was a major donor to Donald Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign. Some $1 million was actually paid as part of that. And it gives you this idea that Gordon Sondland is someone who is perhaps a little like Donald Trump in his image, somebody who has been appointed by the president as into a position that might be regarded by some as unconventional. But he's also somebody who seems to have turned on the president, judging by some of his testimony.
Right. So what leads you to say that?
Well, if you take a look at what he has said here, he has made very clear that he followed the president's orders. And I suspect from all of the testimony today, it's those words that will make headlines. Because he said it was at the express direction of President Trump that essentially he handed over quite a lot of the Ukraine foreign policy to President Trump's own personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. And he said, if I had known all of Giuliani's dealings, I would not have acquiesced to his participation. And this all comes down to the idea that there was this pressure on Ukraine to try to launch an investigation into Mr. Trump's presidential rival or potential presidential rival, Joe Biden, and his son Hunter, who had business dealings in the country with an energy company. Now, this comes down to this phrase that's been used time and time again, Tim, this issue of a quid pro quo. The suggestion is that America was demanding this, or President Trump was demanding this, in return for potentially a White House visit, or alternatively, to ensure that military aid to Ukraine, hundreds of millions of dollars of military aid that was really important to the country, would not be withheld.
Have you had any sense from the questioning or the responses from Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee that any of them are beginning in that case to waver in their foursquare support for President Trump?
Absolutely not. If anything, you have seen the Republicans line up and form a line of defence for the president. In fact, they've been saying time and time again, there are questions that Hunter Biden has to answer about his dealings with this energy company. Now, it must be said, there have been allegations made by the president that are unsubstantiated. No evidence has been presented against Hunter Biden. But at the same time, they continue to push for him to give evidence. They say there are questions for him to answer. Beyond that, they also point out that Gordon Sondland, although he spoke to President Trump, he says that the president at no stage said to him that getting this investigation was contingent on investigations. At no point did the president make that connection. And therefore, they are really pushing Gordon Sondland as somebody who has not essentially given that smoking gun needed in this impeachment hearing.
Chris Buckler in Washington. Iran is reported to have sentenced six conservationists to between 6 and 10 years in jail on charges of spying in a case that has attracted international attention. They were among experts from a wildlife organisation that had been using cameras supposedly to track endangered species, including the Persian leopard and the Asiatic cheetah. The conservationists were arrested early last year by Iran's Revolutionary Guards and accused of using their scientific work as cover while they collected classified information about strategic sites. They've denied the charges. Siavash Mehdi Ardalan from BBC Persian told me more about those who've been given jail sentences.
One of these people is Niloufar Bayani. She was working for UN's environment program in Haiti before she went back to her country of origin, Iran, hoping to save the endangered cheetahs. She also received one of the harshest sentences, 10 years, and she was one of the people whom we know to have stood up in the closed trial against the judge, saying that she was threatened with injection and physical harm so that she could confess to the scenario that they had given her, and the scenario being that these were spies. This is a charge brought by the intelligence wing of the Revolutionary Guards. Now, the Revolutionary Guards is a very powerful institution. It works in parallel with Iran's intelligence ministry, which is more affiliated with a moderate government, who has said during these 2 years of these people being detained that they are not spies. But the Revolutionary Guard held to its guns, saying that they used some very small cameras that conservationists usually use to monitor the activities, the goings and comings of cheetahs, to take pictures of Iran's military installations.
What happens now? Will they just serve their sentences, or is there a chance that they will be released?
Well, they can appeal the sentence theoretically, but given that they had minimal access to their family or to their lawyer, it's very doubtful that that will get anywhere. They've been held in detention for 2 years now, so they haven't had a chance to defend themselves. Also, we had the case during this whole trial of one of the other detainees who died under very suspicious circumstances. They said that he committed suicide for fear of being exposed when they presented him with the allegations, but the CCTV of that was never published.
There's been an outcry, but is it possible that they are guilty as charged?
Well, they haven't presented the evidence. I mean, we don't even know. We haven't read the indictment. They haven't publicly announced the Revolutionary Guards. They haven't publicly announced what these charges are or how they came about. So it's very difficult to, you know, verify the veracity of these charges.
Siavash Mehdi Ardalan from BBC Persian. Next to Zimbabwe. Police used tear gas and batons to disperse crowds gathered to hear a speech by the main opposition leader in Harare. The Movement for Democratic Change accused the police of brutality and likened their tactics to those used during the rule of the former president, Robert Mugabe. The MDC's head, Nelson Chamisa, said it showed that President Emmerson Mnangagwa was scared of the people as the country's economic crisis worsens. Our correspondent, Chingai Nyoka, told me more about what Nelson Chamisa told his supporters.
He said that this was a very sad moment for the people of Zimbabwe, that 24 months ago there was unbelievable and incredible goodwill towards Emmerson Mnangagwa, but then that has dissipated. Zimbabweans are hungry. It's the bleakest and harshest Christmas that Zimbabweans have had in many years. What he was saying is that the two parties need to sit down and dialogue about the way forward.
So why were the police sent in?
Well, the MDC had applied for this to be held at a public park. The police had denied them permission, and then they'd decided that they were going to have this address at the party headquarters. And so when scores of their supporters gathered to hear Nelson Chamisa, who's the leader of the opposition, speak, the police had asked them to disperse or to go inside the building. When they didn't do that, they set upon them with baton sticks. We saw many images of people that were bloody and injured as a result of the violence, essentially, by the police.
But gathering to hear a politician speak, even if it's not the politician that is in support of the government, that's a basic thing in a democracy, isn't it?
It is, and that's what Emmerson Mnangagwa had promised when he came into power 2 years ago. He signed into law an act which did away with some of the draconian laws that were associated with Robert Mugabe. He seems to have gone against this.
Nelson Chamisa suggested that the regime is collapsing. How much truth is there in that?
We've heard comments more and more from ordinary Zimbabweans who supported Emmerson Mnangagwa 2 years ago, who say that under Emmerson Mnangagwa, Zimbabwe is worse off than it was when he took over. We've seen strikes by civil servants. The doctors have been away from work for about 2 months. The prices have gone up. Inflation is at its worst in 10 years. And many people are asking Emmerson Mnangagwa, who had promised so much, just why this is happening, and they blame him for this crisis.
Shingai Nyoka. Also in this podcast.
Since the start of 2018, China has added enough coal to power 31 million homes.
A new study says China is set to build or license enough coal power plants to match the entire coal output of the European Union. Myanmar says its civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi will personally lead a team to the International Court of Justice next month to reject the charge that her country committed genocide against the Rohingya people. More than 700,000 members of the Muslim minority were forced into neighbouring Bangladesh in 2017 as part of a security crackdown by the Myanmar army. Last week, the Gambia filed a case on behalf of 57 countries that are members of the Organisation of Islamic Cooperation. From the main city, Yangon, our Myanmar correspondent Nick Beek sent this report.
For someone who was once a global icon of human rights, it will be the most extraordinary of scenes. Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi will travel to The Hague to tell the world her country has not committed genocide. The judges will be asked to grant so-called provisional measures to make sure Myanmar immediately stops ongoing alleged atrocities against the Rohingya. The ICJ has no way of enforcing its rulings, but Myanmar's international reputation would be further damaged if it acted against the decisions of the court. Ms Suu Kyi does not control the still hugely powerful generals, but has faced searing international criticism for failing to defend the Rohingya.
Nick Beek in Myanmar. Sri Lanka's newly elected president, Gotabaya Rajapaksa, has named his brother, Mahinda, as the country's new prime minister. He's due to be sworn in on Thursday following the resignation of Ranil Wickremesinghe, whose party was defeated in last weekend's election. Electra Naismith has more details.
A spokesman said Mahinda Rajapaksa, a former two-term president, will be sworn in by his younger brother, who won an easy victory in the presidential poll. It cements the grip on power of the Rajapaksas, who a decade ago oversaw the final defeat of Sri Lanka's lengthy Tamil insurgency, allegations of human rights violations have hung over them and the military ever since. Gotabaya Rajapaksa ran a nationalist presidential campaign with support concentrated in Sinhalese majority areas. It raised concerns among Sri Lanka's minorities, who fear the election has reinforced Sri Lanka's deep fractures.
Electra Naismith. A new study by the Global Energy Monitor says that China is set to build or license enough coal power plants to match the coal output of the entire European Union. Scientists are concerned that this development is a serious threat to the Paris climate targets. Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath reports.
China's coal surge can be traced to a decision made by the national government in 2015 to allow provincial authorities to license new coal plants. With these new powers, local officials issued five times more permits than expected. Beijing tried to curb the rise by stalling much of the construction, but researchers say that many of these suspensions have now been lifted. Since the start of 2018, China has added enough coal to power 31 million homes. There's enough new construction in the pipeline now to equal the entire coal power output of the European Union. Researchers say China's reliance on coal threatens the 2-degree temperature target agreed in the Paris Climate Pact. The target was set to keep global warming under control. To keep to this limit, 40% of Chinese coal will have to go by 2030. The report's author Ted Nace says the rise of renewables could make a major difference to Chinese emissions.
I mean, what we're seeing now is the result of the fact that for the first time we have a power source in solar that's mass produced. It's the same as computer chips, same, you know, basic materials, and the same sort of inexorable laws of cost declines. And I just think it's going to really sweep this industry aside over the next decade.
31 countries plan to phase out coal by 2030. But without rapid action from China, the good intentions of other nations will be in vain.
Matt McGrath. And coal mining is the linchpin of many communities. It's estimated that it directly provides employment to 6 million people worldwide. So it stands to reason that helping those miners find alternative livelihoods will also help protect the climate. Our correspondent Mariam Mashiri travelled to northern Spain to meet the woman leading the worldwide campaign to do just that.
We know we have a climate crisis. It's actually an extinction crisis because it risks the very extinction of human beings themselves.
Sharon Burrow is a union boss with a difference. Diminutive but determined, this native Australian has made it her mission to defend the climate as well as workers. She's come to Castilla y León in northern Spain to talk to former miners here about their uncertain future. For years, the Spanish mining industry has been economically unviable, and the move away from dirty fuels like coal because of climate change is sounding a death knell for the industry. But as one door closes, could more open? Sharon has come to visit the Escondida mine a few hours outside León and talk to the owner about what will happen to the mine and the workers who once made their living here. At the end of last year, Spain reached an agreement with unions and the companies involved to shut down all its remaining coal mines. A deal was forged which promised $277 million to help miners like these retire early or retrain. They called it the Just Transition and believe it's a model for the rest of the world. Sharon is here to tell miners there is help for them, but that the Spanish coal mining industry is done. But some of the former miners here, like Santiago Calvo, don't agree.
Coal has a future. The EU says it doesn't have a future in Spain, but other countries are still producing coal, and Spain is still processing coal from abroad. And that's even worse because of the footprint. But coal has a future, that's for sure.
Okay, perfect.
Sharon is getting her hard hat and suit fitted so she can go down into the mine to see for herself. This is something she's very used to doing, as this is one of many she's visited around the world to reassure workers about their future. Globally, around 6 million people are employed in coal mining, and in parts of Asia, coal-fired power stations are still being built. Round here, though, things are very different. Sharon understands the frustrations of these miners, but believes there's no other way.
We need to build living jobs on a sustainable planet. And if the planet is to live, we need dramatic ambition. So for us, just transition, involving people in the design of their own future, is the high ambition pathway, because that will give people hope, that will support governments to take those decisions and will indeed demand them.
And that report by Mariam Mashiri in Spain. There are a few single factors more important to the quality of your life than the country in which you were born. Many people spend their savings, even risk their lives, to leave one nationality behind and start a new life in a new country. An annual study of which nationality is the best one to have has French once again on top. But if you're British, well, things are on the slide. Jonathan Savage reports.
Hello, my name is Maribel Ayala and I'm Spanish.
Marhaba, my name is Fadi and I come from Lebanon.
I'm Olivia and I'm British.
Hi, my name is Bart and I'm from Poland.
Where are you from? The answer to that question can tell me a lot. For example, what languages you might speak, where you've got the right to live and work, and what sort of freedoms and opportunities you've been privileged to throughout your life. The Quality of Nationality Index is a study that looks at all these factors and more besides. It tells us there's nothing better to be in the world than a citizen of France. Dr. Chris Kalin, an expert in investment migration, is one of the authors.
Western, but also some Asian countries that are generally liberal, rule of law-based societies tend to be at the top end. They give generally visa-free access to other countries, give you a good environment at home. They're generally more wealthy countries.
My name is Matthew, and I'm French and British.
Yes, the UK is 8th on the list, but that could fall to 56th if certain things happen in the future.
There is a little element of Brexit, of course. There is a danger that Britain will fall behind. Of course, should there be a rather larger impact Brexit, which I actually don't think will be the case at all, but should there be, then this would also have an impact on the quality of nationality of Britain.
My name is Alison and I'm South African.
You have to go all the way down to 25th to find a non-European country, the US.
My name is Haley and I'm a United States American.
Why so low? I asked Dr. Kalin.
The US is a single country, and as a national of that single country, you only have the right to live, work and do business in one state. Even if you want to move to Canada, you can't just do that. Furthermore, in the US, there's too much violent crime, too many people in prisons.
My name is Javier, and I'm from Spain.
Hi, my name is Leo. I'm from Argentina.
Hello, my name is Ara. I'm from China.
Importantly, things change. The United Arab Emirates is a recent riser up the league table as its government negotiates visa waiver schemes with other countries. But regional conflicts can have a negative effect. Qatari nationality has fallen 25 places in the last 5 years. They're now ranked 78th.
Jonathan Savage. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.